the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The court is hearing arguments today on case number 20488, in-way request of Governor Kristi Noem for an advisory opinion. Based on the nature of the governor's inquiries in this case, the court entered an order on October 31st directing the governor, the legislature, and the attorney general to submit briefs in the case. The court also received a separate brief from State Representative John Hansen and several of his colleagues of their view of South Dakota Constitution Article 3, Section 12. After receiving the briefs, the court set oral arguments this morning for the parties that were originally directed to submit briefs. Katie Harisco will be arguing on behalf of the governor, Ronald Parsons Jr. arguing on behalf of the legislature, and Attorney General Marty Jackley will also be arguing this morning. The order sets arguments for 20 minutes for each of you. If we determine rebuttals necessary, we'll talk about that before we conclude this morning. So with that, we'll hear first from you, Ms. Harisco.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Katie Harisco, and I am General Counsel for Office of the Governor, and I'm appearing here on behalf of Governor Kristi Noem. Governor Noem did ask me to extend her sincere appreciation to all of you for the expedited manner in which the court has taken up this matter, and thank you for this truly unique opportunity to address these issues, both in brief and in oral argument, as to why the court should answer the 9 questions posed. The 2024 legislative session begins just tomorrow afternoon, and with 2 vacant legislative seats. The 9 questions posed in the governor's request are supported by both chambers of the legislature and by the attorney general. The governor is requesting the court's interpretation of the interested contracts clause of Article 3, Section 12 of the South Dakota Constitution. Article 5, Section 5 of our Constitution is the basis for this request. In that article, the court must answer questions of advisory opinions in either situations that involve important questions of law of the governor's executive power or on solemn occasions. The request here presents important questions that should be answered for 3 reasons. The governor has to appoint a qualified and eligible legislator to each of the open seats, but also because state law requires the governor to supervise the administration of federal and state funds, and also because these are solemn occasions. I'll first address in 2 ways why these questions are affecting the exercise of the governor's executive power, and then I'll address why these are solemn occasions. First, the governor, as I stated, and the Constitution allows for the court to answer requests for advisory opinions on important questions involving the exercise of the governor's executive power. As this court has held in In Re Noem from 2020, the court reserves answering questions in only situations that have to do with her executive power that will result in immediate consequences having impacts on to the institutions of our state government. The first power implicated here is Article 3, Section 10 of the Constitution, which grants to the governor the authority to appoint legislators to vacancies. Answers to the questions here will ensure that the governor is appointing a legislator to each seat who will not have direct or indirect interests in any contracts with the state for the laws which they would pass during their term. This situation is very akin to the question from Governor Dugard when he asked of this court to consider the constitutional eligibility requirements of appointing a Supreme Court justice when it came to the constitutional requirement for residency.
The question in that instance, and also the question that was posed in In Re Noem, however, were presented differently. So rather than an illustration of unique fact-bound circumstances, such as what we have here, those seem to be broader inquiries. could we synthesize from this collection or some of this collection an overarching question? Because it may well be that there's an argument, even though no one's making it here today, that these questions reflect more individual concerns and individual fact-bound cases that may not be fully explored in the context of a request for an advisory opinion. It would maybe be better developed through a more traditional means of litigation. Can we take something from these 9 questions and synthesize a broader question, or are we relegated to answering only these 9 questions as they are currently stated?
Thank you, Justice Salter. The way that the request was made to the court was asking these 9 questions as a whole to try to give the governor and those who rely on the Constitution, who need to comply with it, kind of guidepost on what is in and what is out when we're looking at an interpretation of the direct and indirect contracts. Those questions, the 9 questions posed, are the ones most often received by our office and that we've heard the greatest concern of. And so
to follow up on Justice Salter's question, when we start talking about direct and indirect's pretty broad. Would you agree?
Yes, sir.
So if that's the case, we're presented 9 questions of different scenarios, but there could be facts that might impact those scenarios, which gets to the ultimate question of, can we dig into these questions that could be pretty detailed or could be very fact-bound on a direct or indirect determination? And how do we do that in an advisory opinion outside of the context of a litigated case where there are adversaries on both sides that present evidence and tell us, here's why it's direct or indirect or not?
Thank you, Chief Justice Jensen. First, I would say in Re Nome, I think that was a question similar in nature to these questions, whether a legislator could contract with the state to receive COVID benefits under the Small Business Grant Program. And the court in Re Nome determined weighing the factors and that it involved an important question of the governor's executive power and did indeed answer that. I would also maybe highlight, as far as one test, the Attorney General's brief does offer sort of a synthesized test, and that would be, if could the contract have been entered into between the state and the legislature if the legislature had not passed the law in question. And so I think that may be a good synthesized test that could be applied to all of those.
I don't want to get too far into the merits because I know you're talking about this preliminary question, but maybe that's inevitable that we get there, and maybe we get there sort of this way. But, and I'm asking this question after having reviewed and spent time and studied all 3 of the briefs, and as you know, we sent out a letter last week and said, hey, be prepared to talk about everyone's brief. It seems to me that there is an implicit idea in the inquiry, all 3 of the submissions, and the reason why we're here, that the current state of the law is viewed as being unsatisfactory in terms of having clarity, in terms of having workability. Would you agree with that?
Sorry, just to, I don't know if I heard you right, Justice Salter.
Is there an implicit premise that the current state of the law is not satisfactory in terms of providing clarity?
Thank you. I would say that given the, I think there's 5 South Dakota opinions that we can rely on. And when you look at those, that leaves significant gaps on whether another example may fall into one of those.
Does it? Because the Constitution says there can be, a legislator cannot have any interest, direct or indirect. There's an argument there that component can't be parsed at all. No interest. None. If that's true, then isn't our rule, which is the more contemporary view of this that we expressed in asphalt surfacing, isn't that the answer to all these questions? And if it's not, then isn't there an implied sort of sentiment that it's just not satisfactory? That's the legislature's view, or the view of the leadership of the legislature, that maybe it's not satisfactory. Maybe we have an issue that we need to think about in terms of where our cases are right now.
Thank you, Justice Salter. I think what I can say is there's enough uncertainty that has caused enough hesitation with vendors to the state and our state agencies that no one wants to violate the Constitution. They want as much clarity as they can get. And when they look at from Palmer all the way to In Re Nome, there's not been that specific fact question presented to the court, which gives us the certainty. In Re Nome was very, very specific, clear guidance that was able to then be used to enforce a potential violation. And so I think what we're looking for here today in this request is more specific guidance just like that. And the nine questions posed, I think, would be a good totality that gives us some guidance and some boundaries on how far and what is an indirect interest.
So rather than proceed to address the nine specific questions, which are fact-bound, certainly some of them are highly fact-bound, in your view, are we free to reformulate the question to provide that clarity in the fashion that you're suggesting?
Yes, thank you, Justice Kern. Yes, if the court finds that the way that the questions are phrased would be could be adjusted to give even better, more clear guidance, we'd absolutely appreciate that.
Let me just pose the question to you, and I know you address it in your brief. May a vendor of the state receive state payment if the vendor employs a legislator, and such legislator is not the owner? So let's take a scenario where you have a legislator working for a medical provider who receives Medicaid payments from the state. They get paid by that employer. That would seem to be an indirect benefit. So wouldn't the answer be no?
Thank you, Chief Justice. I think the legislator's brief does a good job to lay out how the different facts and circumstances may impact that scenario if there's compensation structure that would create an indirect interest, or if there was solicitation of business or actual negotiating of the contract as an employee, that there may not be a clear and fast rule that can be created, but at least a factor analysis that could be applied if
You're
we are...
To discern between direct and indirect.
Or just to discern if there's an indirect interest of sufficient... that's a sufficient indirect interest to warrant considering it a violation that would have to then be enforced.
It seems like the Constitution says no interest, any interest. And maybe the text, direct or indirect, isn't so much a comment upon quantifying interest as it is an emphatic means of saying no interest, none. If that's true, can we parse indirect? And are we looking at the wrong part of the contract clause of Article 3, Section 12? The legislature suggests that maybe we are, and maybe our cases have. And in one of the things that I think that they bring out, and this gets into maybe what our letter was last week, see what you think, if you have a position, maybe you don't. There's another constitutional provision that seems to be looming large, and it's Article 12, Section 2. And in that section, and in the way we've construed it in Oster and in other cases that predate, by the way, our 1986 decision on asphalt surfacing, that provision of our Constitution, Article 12, Section 2, seems to have a very circumscribed view of what general appropriation can do or be. And yet, in asphalt surfacing, we said general appropriation is authorization, period. In about one sentence, we said that. Can those coexist? Are we looking at the right part of Article 3, Section 12? And are we even looking at, when we discuss this view, the right constitutional provision? Or do we have to also look at Article 12, Section 2 and the way the legislature discharges its ability to distinguish between those ordinary and current expenses that are the correct subject of general appropriation versus all other appropriations that must be the subject of special appropriation.
Thank you, Chief Justice, or Justice Salter. I think the way that the unique proceedings have come before the court, as a request by the governor for the court's interpretation, makes it so that the governor doesn't have and hasn't stated a position in her briefs. We don't think that that's her proper role. Whatever the court decides and interprets the Constitution, then it is our role to enforce and implement that interpretation. And so I think that the legislature's brief makes the argument that the general appropriation bill does nothing but appropriate money and sets out those funds in blanket appropriations to the state agencies. That's certainly one argument that on the fourth element of the Interstate Contracts Clause, I think the Attorney General's brief offers kind of that overarching test that we've already talked about, trying to could it be that if the law didn't pass, could the state agency have still entered into that contract and approved payments from it? And I think those are very, very different tests, and they can't both be correct.
So what authorization from the legislature is necessary for the state to enter into a binding contract with a third party? Can the state enter into a binding contract if the legislature has not appropriated the necessary funds? So if we look at authorize in Article 3, Section 12, does it encompass both the legal authority to contract and the funds necessary to do so?
Thank you, Justice Kern. I think both asphalt surfacing pits and in Raynome have said that the general appropriation bill does count, and until those are overturned, those would be the law. And so when we look at does the general appropriation bill, what does it do to authorize the state agencies to enter into contracts and spend those funds? I would suggest that the state agencies could do nothing if the legislature has not given it the authority within the appropriation bill to spend state general funds or federal funds or other funds. Even if they're federal funds, we still need the general appropriation bill to pass to grant that authority to the agency to then move on with day-to-day operations and contract and approve those funds. I think it would be against state law for state agencies to do anything other than follow or make sure that the general appropriation bill has authorized their payments.
The legislature suggested that we should alter course on that. So if we were to alter course on that argument and say the appropriations bill is not effective in that way, how does that change your thought process?
Thank you, Justice Myron. I think until the court concludes otherwise, we would still enforce it that way, and it would be, I think, pretty significant. However, other states have also, in our brief and in the Attorney General's brief, we've highlighted other states that have a similar constitutional provision, and they have taken that approach. And so that could be the path that we take. The governor doesn't offer support or rejection of that path. And if that's what the court indeed determined here, that would be how we would enforce the Constitution.
Counsel, taking a step back, in fairness, I don't know if you had been contemplating the question that you were given with regard to whether or not if this court would find some of the specific questions to be very fact-bound and not the sort that are conducive to an advisory opinion outside a litigated context. And you indicated that you thought that I think you answered that yes, that perhaps they could be reformulated into a more general type inquiry. Do you have thoughts at this point on what type of a more general inquiry that could be that could provide some of the guideposts and direction that the governor is requesting?
Thank you, Justice Devaney. In fairness, it's not a question that I had thought of. And so I think I would probably just have to rely on at least the nature of the nine questions that have been posed to try to give us those those boundaries, I don't know that I can craft a new, more broader question that could, that the court could then give some bright line rule for. I think a lot of the questions may lend themselves to more of a bright line directive, much like the In Re Nom question did, but others, as the Attorney General pointed out in his brief, may require more of a fact analysis. And if we have those factors, then those can be applied when we're looking at enforcing, either enforcing potential violations or making more inquiries on whether this contract can be validly entered into. I think we've talked a lot about the merits. I would just end relying on our brief that these certainly are solemn occasions. The court has asked a lot of the questions that the factors require some analysis on, whether these involve private rights or are broader conflict of interest questions. We've kind of hit on that, and I think that factor certainly weighs in favor of responding to these. I think this request is sort of, if I take algebra, it's kind of plus In Re Dugard plus In Re Nom equals this request. I think we have both the exercise of the governor's power to appoint at play and also the administration of federal and state funds, which were in play in both the In Re Dugard and In Re Nom case. And this is maybe even to a broader extent. So with that, I would just thank the court for its expedited manner in handling all this and letting me address the court on this solemn occasion. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Carson, you may proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and on behalf of the South Dakota Legislature, may it please the court, the Governor's Office, the Attorney General's Office, and my friends at Council's tables. Today, I would suggest, is an historic occasion. If it is not the first time, it is certainly one of the very rare times in which each of the three co-equal branches of our state government are gathered or represented here in their official capacities in this grand courtroom on the second floor of our state capitol building. We are here today to consider the convergence of four supporting beams in the, what I would call, the beautiful architecture of our state constitution. The governor's executive power to request advisory opinions from this court, the executive appointment power, the appropriations clause of Article 12, and the contracts clause of Article 3. Given the public attention on this issue, I know this is something the court obviously understands utterly and completely, but I think it's worth reiterating and emphasizing that the ultimate question here today is not what rules ought to govern conflicts of interest for legislators who may have an interest in contracts. What should the rules be? That's not the question here today. That is a very important public policy question, but I think we can all agree here that it's not a question committed to the judicial branch. Rather, the overriding question here today is one that solicits the wise guidance from this court, and that is, what does the plain meaning of the text of the contracts clause actually prohibit? And when interpreting constitutional provisions, of course, this court applies the plain meaning of its text, and we presume the framers said what they meant and meant what they said. I wanted to address the question that came up in Ms. Herska's presentation, which was, is this court limited to the nine questions precisely as they have been formulated? And I would suggest no. I believe this court, under the constitutional provision, is the sole arbiter of the extent and form of the advice that it provides to the government, if it agrees to do so. So my understanding of this court's role in giving an advisory opinion, which is a rare occasion where this court's authorized to give advice, is that this court gives the advice that it believes is prudent and ought to give. And so I think this court is clear to reframe the questions and give advice only to the extent it agrees ought to be provided, that is necessary.
Well, the text of the Constitution doesn't specifically say that in terms of what the court can and can't do.
either it says we can or can't do that that you're aware of?
No, other than that deciding these legal questions and fulfilling its duty under this clause is something that no other branch could intrude upon, and it's up to this court. So I think this court has been invested with the power to answer the questions as it will, as it would. But I don't have outside legal authority for that question, Your Honor.
Its original jurisdiction, to be sure, narrow and confined to those alternative instances where the governor's exercise of executive power is implicated or solemn occasions is also implicated. We've considered those to be either or. You don't need them both, of course. So is the argument sort of the position sort of as long as we're connected sufficiently to the area or the areas of inquiry, that would be sufficient to implicate the Article 5, Section 5 original jurisdiction, which we otherwise don't have? I mean, there's an aversion to advisory opinions in litigated cases, as you know. So, but this is an exception. Yeah. So that nexus or that connection, as long as that's sufficient in recasting, reformulating, culling, synthesizing, whatever, that would still be sufficient to implicate our jurisdiction?
I think so. And maybe another way of saying is that this court answers the questions, but it answers them in the way that it believes is prudent advice. So in answering each of those nine questions, the advice may be essentially the same. The answer may be essentially the same that this court gives in terms of a broad framework. And then to the extent this court believes it can go into additional detail, then it will.
Your brief is built principally upon, you've mentioned it already today, a textual interpretation of Article 12, Section Article 3, Section 12. You pull in other authorities, including the Appropriation Clause, and I want to talk about that. But let's talk about the text, and let's talk about the state, if you could, please, of our law. Do you see, it seems as though you do you see asphalt surfacing as a point of departure from Article 3, Section 12's text?
I do. I do clearly, Your Honor. Asphalt surfacing, and you mentioned, there really is no reasoning in asphalt surfacing. It's kind of an ipsy-dixit on the question. It frames the proper question, and then in about three sentences, it glosses over. It says, well, obviously it's a broad clause, so obviously it includes general appropriations. It's not an unfair description of the analysis chain in asphalt surfacing. But if you go back to the text and then proceed from this court's cases, from that text, starting in Palmer, there was an act that specifically authorized a contract outside legal services by the Railway Board. A legislator got one of those contracts, clearly violated the authorization because he was in the legislature when that Railway Act was passed. There's dicta in there that's very expansive about the spirit and public policy and the crusading nature kind of that the clause was perceived to have. And that dicta took hold in some of these other states. You go to Norbeck. Norbeck 1 clearly violated the contract clause. A sitting senator was there when a special appropriation was passed to dig a well. He then got the contract authorized by that special appropriation. Clearly violated it. But again, Justice McCoy, we suggested, went broad. It's more, reads to me, more like a speech than a legal opinion. And Justice Whiting very respectfully pointed that out in his very wise concurrence that no, it's the authorization. We're talking about authorizing a contract. But really, this court's most substantive decision addressing the contracts clause is its least cited, and that is Norbeck 2. Norbeck 2, Senator Norbeck, a very industrious person, came back and said, I understand. I was in the legislature when the contract for digging that well was authorized, but I don't necessarily have to be paid from funds that came from that special appropriation. I could be paid with other funds. And this court said, no, you've got it absolutely wrong, Senator Norbeck. The validity of the contract is in no manner dependent upon the sources from which state funds may be derived to liquidate the indebtedness created by the contract. It's the authorization not the mere funding that controls. It's the authority to do something, and that's the dictionary definition, the legal definition of authorize. And this court the framers understood that. They understood what an appropriation was, and they understood what it meant to authorize something by the legislature, and we know they understood that because they are the architects of both separate processes, the appropriations clause or provision, an entire article, and the contracts clause, which is meant to control, prohibit direct or indirect interests in the authorization of a contract.
Do you agree with the with this statement that any interest, direct or indirect, cannot be parsed?
I disagree to some extent. I appreciated, Justice Salter, your comment about what did they mean by direct or indirect. Are they just trying to emphasize we mean nothing? I take a slightly different view, and which you also alluded to in a different question. Direct or indirect refers to the route that the interest takes. It's not you can have a substantial or a trivial. That's not the clarification. It's the route. So is it a payment going directly to a legislator, or is it a payment going to a business that is owned by a legislature? That's an indirect route, which was what NORDEC was. So that's what I believe direct and indirect means. I don't think it would be reasonable, and there are canons of constructions about not just absurdity, but impracticality. I don't think it would be reasonable. I don't think it could be assumed that what the legislator meant was any, even a trivial interest in a contract. You own one share in a corporation of a large company, and that large company got some contract from the state. I don't think anyone would reasonably say a trivial interest was intended to be covered. So I would parse it to that extent, Your Honor. But I do agree. They didn't say direct, only direct. They said direct or indirect. So that has to be given muscular meaning, indirect.
So, counsel, you are asking this court to make a course correction. Could you succinctly set out what your view of that course correction should entail?
Yes. My view is that authorization means what the dictionary says it means, which is to grant the legal power to do something, not to fund it. You can enter into a contract and then have it never be paid, never be funded. The state and counties are sued for breach of contract all the time. They express authority for it to do that. But in my view, respectfully, the view of the legislature is that maybe things have changed, but that would require new laws, new constitutional amendments, things like that. But at the time this was enacted, most projects, most contracts were the subject of special authorizations, and the general appropriation bill was constitutionally required to embrace nothing but these blanket appropriations to the various departments of agencies of the state. My view is that cannot be an authorization of whatever of the thousands today of thousands of contracts that may or may not be entered into as the result of a grant of a $350 million to the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks.
And though NORDEC 2 may, in your view, be more significant, the legacy of NORDEC 1 is, of course, that those contracts are void.
The legacy of NORDEC
1 is that those contracts are void. That is what the court said in NORDEC 1. So the stakes are very high.
I would disagree that that is what the court said in NORDEC 1, because NORDEC 1 was a special appropriation that granted the authority and the funds. So I don't think the court ever mentioned the general appropriation bill until, as you said, the 1980s.
They said the contracts that are prohibited are void.
Yes, contracts that are prohibited, correct, of course, are void. That's, yes, right. Absolutely.
Is that too fine of a distinction between general and special appropriations? General says, okay, we're going to fund government. We're going to fund all the ordinary expenses. Special, that every constitutional provision says, the legislature is going to pass a bill that embraces just one option. It may not authorize a contract. It may just be a special appropriation that says we're going to give money for this purpose, which is really what the general appropriation does. Isn't that kind of a fine place to cut between the general and special appropriation?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because because of just the way you framed the question. A special appropriation says we're giving the money for this purpose. The general appropriation bill says we're giving the Department of Education $950 million.
Well, what if it's known that there's a huge infrastructure project underway, a prison, for example, or an airport, something of massive cost that will take years to develop. And so there's a massive amount that's appropriated to a specific agency to accomplish that task for this infrastructure project. Can a legislature then vote to distribute funding for such a project under a general appropriations bill and then submit a bid for a subcontract?
I think under the text it could, because if all that is enacted by the legislature, in which a legislator is sitting, is that the Department of Transportation is going to get this year $2,100,000. I don't think that that legislature has authorized by the law that it passed. We're looking at the law that it passed, not unspoken intentions or expectations. The law merely gave funds to the Department of Transportation.
But that comes back to my question, which is one purpose, special appropriation, all funding all purposes of government. Let's say a legislator knows that, and they do, because they come in, various agencies come in front of appropriations and say, you know, we're going to need money for this, and we're going to enter into a contract here, we're going to need $1 million for that, things like that. Again, it gets back to that fine distinction between general and special. Legislators know, well, theoretically, what all they're funding. It's a huge broad-based bill, as you presented in your briefing. But they know or can ask what they're funding these various agencies for.
Theoretically. And I think you have to go back to the text. Authorized by any law. Did an appropriation to the Department of the Interior, or the Department of Transportation for a blanket amount, did that authorize the contract? A contract authorized by any law.
But this discussion seems like incomplete unless we have proper understanding of Article 12, Section 2, and the cases that interpret it, including Oster and Duxbury. We've got a case called Mills from 1950, and these cases illuminate to some degree what it means to have general appropriation topics and ones that aren't. So, for instance, in Oster, 1965, we said, this is what ordinary means, this is what current means, and by the way, the meanings are kind of what you think they would mean. It's the sort of expenses that are necessary to fund state government, kind of like it was last year and the year before, and how it's been going along. Capital expenditures, buying land, doing other things like that, that's special.
Right.
So don't we have to have a more broader discussion and a proper understanding of that constitutional amendment, that constitutional provision in Article 12, Section 2, to really complete this discussion?
I do. I sought to provide that solely appropriations, solely for a general appropriation. That's all that can be in there. Purpose is not part of the constitutional requirement in Article 12, Section 2.
And to the extent that history plays a part, and I think history could play a part, although there's no argument that I see in the submissions that someone's saying, hey, this is how they would have understood the text, and we can discern some original intent here by that. I don't really see that, but we do have some history that makes clear that throughout the 1880s and as we had constitutional conventions, that there was a strong anti-corruption sentiment. And Article 3, Section 12 may be part of that. Article 12, Section 2 may be part of that. Is there any indication that would, from history, from text, that would support the view that voting on a general appropriation bill does nothing more than fund ordinary current expenses could somehow be a source of corruption?
I don't think so. There's nothing in the text. That's for certain. Let me put it this way, Your Honor. The framers did not intend for this to be a guessing game when they enacted this article. Holding that the blanket general appropriation bill, which is constitutionally limited to only these blanket sums distributed to agencies, ensures, renders the question unknowable. For a legislator who is sitting there wondering how many thousands of contracts are or aren't eventually going to be authorized by these departments who get this money. Sometimes there's an intent to do a project and it's not even bid that year. You know, they reorganize the funds and at the DOT. I mean, you cannot know if you're a sitting legislator when every year that there's a general appropriation bill passed, you cannot know what that's going to go to. And it's going to go to thousands and thousands of different places, and it may go to some, and it may go to not. You don't know that when you're voting. It's impossible. It's a guessing game. So no regular person with an ordinary income, with a paycheck, a regular business, in their right mind would risk their livelihoods or their spouse's livelihood in the hope that they're not going to eventually, down the line, years down the line, be deemed to be on the wrong side of an unknowable line. We want regular people to serve in peer. The framers wanted regular people to serve in our part-time citizen legislature, and if you cannot know, under the current standard, you're throwing a dart at a wall to see if you're going to be on this side of the line. Maybe that contract will eventually be authorized, maybe it won't. That can't be what the framers intended, and we know from the language they chose, authorized by any law enacted by the legislature, not funded by the general appropriation bill, merely funded by the general appropriation bill. I think that's as clear as a line as we're ever going to have, and I salute the wisdom of the framers and the people who adopted our organic law in making that textual distinction between those two, both in the contracts clause and in the appropriations article.
Can you address the Attorney General's proposed rule statement? And I'll ask whether or not this is indeed the proposed rule statement as cited by Ms. Haruska.
My understanding is that came from a law student's note in a natural resources journal. I couldn't even find that article. It's cited in some Attorney General's opinions in some other states. I don't agree with that article. I don't agree with the premise, which it seems to be in that, and I've not been able to read the article, but I don't agree with the premise if the suggestion is that it is the payment that gives force and effect to a contract. The payment fulfills the contract. The funds fulfill the contract. The authority to enter into the contract is what authorizes it, the legal authority. What gives this department the right to enter into a particular contract? That, not the funding. And Justice Kern, your question earlier when you said, is authorization just the legal authority, or is it the legal authority and the funding? I respectfully think the question kind of answers itself. Is the authorization the legal authority? Well, yes, that's what authorization is. Is it also the funding? No, that's not what legal authority means. Legal authority does not mean funding. Funding comes later.
One last question that I have. You cited the Legislative Code of Conduct 1B2. Is there anything beyond that that's relevant in this discussion?
There are certain statutes, but the main statutes that address contractual conflicts of interest don't include legislators. I think the reason is that it was kind of presumed while they're covered by a constitutional provision. Most states do not have this constitutional provision. I think there's a reason for that. That's because their ethics laws, their laws that govern conflicts of interest, are deliberated by their policy-making bodies, and they're enacted as statutes. Maybe this is policy we're talking about at the bottom line. So most states do that through their statutes. And respectfully, I think that's what ought to be occurring in South Dakota, and I suspect it will, depending on how this court rules. But in terms of what does the Constitution actually prohibit, I think the line, I'm not saying it's an open and shut case, there are arguments on all sides of all of these questions, but to me, the clearest line, the most workable line, is also the line that lines up with the actual text of the Constitution, as that is authorized. When they said authorized by any law, they said what they meant, and they meant what they said, Your Honors.
Are there other questions
from Mr. Burns? I do have one. I read your brief and studied it, and I can kind of maybe clean the answer, but
but I don't know that I've asked it, or I know this directly. Is there any way to reconcile the holding in asphalt surfacing that general appropriation equals authorization with the way we have interpreted Article 12, Section 2 and OSTER? Are they on a collision course? Can they coexist?
They cannot coexist. Your Honor, I think asphalt surfacing and the Pitts decision are in direct contradiction to Norbeck 2.
Question about In Re Nome. Though it used some of the broad language that we had forged in asphalt surfacing and in Pitts, Nome, at least it seems to me, might be a different case, because there was a special session in October 2020, and even though the legislature folded in the COVID relief fund money to its general appropriation, there was a joint Senate resolution or concurrent resolution that seemed to provide, and I read it, seemed to provide specific authorization. If that's the case, the answer in In Re Nome is right, even though maybe some of the rules that were pulled in from these earlier cases.
Yes, I think that's accurate. I think In Re Nome is the unique outlier situation. There you have what is essentially a line item amendment. You know, it's a one page, if I remember correctly, a one page law that distributes these funds married to this joint resolution that gives the very specific purposes that every legislator knows that these funds are going to be used for. So that, to me, is the outlier situation that may prove the rule.
But it would look a little more like Palmer and Norbeck.
It would look a little more like Palmer and Norbeck, true. But that, to me, should be the, if there is a case that needs to be distinguished, it would be In Re Nome. And that Palmer, the holdings of Palmer, Norbeck 1 and Norbeck 2, this court, I would suggest, ought to return to those strict holdings and overrule asphalt surfaces and pits.
Well, overrule, or are the statements in those cases dictum?
I would leave that to the court's wisdom, but that's an excellent point, Chief Justice Jensen. It's an excellent point.
With reference to stare decisis?
Well, stare decisis has, as the Supreme Court has said, and I think this court has said, but I know the United States Supreme Court has said, stare decisis has its least effect when you're talking about a constitutional provision. Laws can be amended and changed, and so people know what they're getting, but constitutions are interpreting the organic law. And so stare decisis, I don't think, stands as any impediment to correct what was, I suggest, an incorrect turn that the courts in the 1980s took, where the courts from Norbeck and Palmer, their holdings were, I think, exactly correct, not the rhetoric in the decisions.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Jack, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel. In 1898, this court made a profound and enduring statement in Palmer regarding the interpretation of Article 3, Section 12. According to the words of this court, the language of the Constitution is plain. Its meaning cannot be mistaken. The purpose of the provision is apparent. It is intended to preclude the possibility of any member deriving directly or indirectly any pecuniary benefit from legislation of which he or she is a member. It is intended to remove any suspicion which might otherwise attach to the motives of the members who advocate the creation of new offices or the expenditure of public funds. I would submit as Attorney General to you that this case boils down to three issues. The first issue rests in Article 5, the Governor's Council did an excellent job of talking about Article 5, Section 5 on the importance of this executive authority and the solemn occasion.
So assuming we find one or both of those situations,
Mr. Parsons suggests that we can reformulate the governor's questions if we make that determination and we don't have to answer all nine. What's your view of that?
I agree with Mr. Parsons. I believe that Article 5, Section 5 is one of discretion. So even though this is an important executive authority and a solemn occasion, I believe the law indicates that it is a discretionary matter for this court, and in exercising that discretion, it can answer three questions or nine questions. And I would submit to this court that based upon what the Attorney General sees as a second and a third issue is why this court can and should exercise that discretion. The Attorney General believes the second issue is what is a direct or indirect benefit. I would point out, and this goes to some of Justice Salter's questions, that in looking at Article 3, Section 12, it doesn't say any interest. It says any contract and authorized by any law. The Attorney General has set forth what it believes the appropriate standard should be. That standard should apply to all nine of the questions. That standard finds its basis not necessarily in a law school commentary, but in then Attorney General Janklow's Attorney General opinion in Todd. And it's a very simple standard. And that is whether the interest has any tendency to affect the judgment of the legislator. If it does, it's a conflict and off limits. As part of that analysis, then Attorney General Janklow and Todd relied upon Robinson v. State, the North Dakota Supreme Court decision on nominal versus substantial interest. I would submit if this court were to apply that standard, it's been applied by Attorney General since Janklow, Meyer, Henry, Tellinghusen, Barnett, Long, and Jackley. It works. I would submit that a further expounding on it, like perhaps the court did in Hennig, where it put forth five factors to be looked at on that indirect pecuniary interest with respect to the waitress that was on city council gaining tips with respect to that being a conflict, would be appropriate. I think that does service.
If what you said at the outset is the law from the Palmer Pope, and it's and there's an argument that that was broader than was necessary, because Palmer involves special legislation and special appropriation and special authorization. So there's an argument that that was dicta. It wasn't central to the holding. It didn't need to be that broad. It was a platitude and didn't need to be that broad. But if it wasn't, and if it's the law, as you say, then the answer is the answer. The answer is self-evident from asphalt surfacing. And the clarity that is sought in terms of when does indirect become too indirect could be achieved in any number of other ways, but not the least of which is legislation. In the Attorney General's brief, there are a number of authorities cited from the five other states that have a constitutional provision like this. Mississippi is one of them, and it's virtually the same constitutional provision that we have in Article 3, Section 12. Mississippi has a lengthy statute in which they say these contracts are okay, these aren't. And one of the things they did in that statutory scheme is they identified and defined material financial benefit, or material financial benefit, which is another way of, it's a euphemism for indirect. And could the legislature do that here? In other words, they have what our cases say. The legislature could maybe have a statute or enact a statute that looks a lot like Mississippi. Could that be a resolution?
Absolutely. The legislature certainly could do that. In the absence of that legislation, this court has issued plenty of authority on what substantial is, substantial compliance with respect to elections.
There's some risk. And maybe Mr. Parsons' right, maybe everyone's right, and maybe interest direct or indirect can be parsed. But if we were to hold in this case that it can't be parsed, then the legislature can probably never do that, because that would preemptively take that ability to parse indirect out of its control, because we would have then held that indirect is indirect and one share of stock is indirect.
But I would submit that isn't what the Constitution says, because it doesn't say any interest. And if you look at the way the Attorney General has applied it, again, every Attorney General since Janklow and Todd, whether there's an a tendency to influence, and I think that is the appropriate standard. It brings in substantial and nominal, pays homage to Norbeck 1, talking about a legislature serving in that trust fiduciary responsibility. And I would further submit that, appreciating that Palmer was an attorney receiving payment, I think it was $860 out of $4,500, the language of Palmer and what it discusses, I think, applies to a general appropriations bill. So I would submit to this court that the only decision of this court that wasn't pertaining and talking about a general appropriations was Norbeck 1. Even if you get to Norbeck 2, where they talk about other state funds, that can apply to a general appropriations bill, which then turns me to the third issue, and that is, what does authorized by any law mean? And I would submit to you, as this court did in Palmer, the language is clear. Authorized by any law, an appropriation is a law.
What about the legislature's argument that general appropriation, as it is defined and visualized with special appropriation in Article 12, Section 2, and the way it's been interpreted by this court, cannot support the determination, the sustained determination and holding of asphalt surfacing that general appropriation equals authorization, because the view is that Article 12, Section 2 means that general appropriation cannot go that far. It is nothing more than funding ordinary current expenses and interest on the debt and common school expenses.
The Attorney General reaches the position of the legislature in a different way, and that is with respect to the appropriate standard under Todd and under Robinson. The Attorney General's position is that a general appropriation applies. It's that position based upon the text of the Constitution. It's that position based upon every decision this court has issued with respect to a general appropriations, with the exception of Norbeck 1. It reaches that decision based upon every Attorney General opinion, from Brinkman in Janklow to Tellinghuizen, with respect to Anderson Rounds, with respect to Long and the continuing appropriation.
Oster's one, as I said, there's Mills in 1950, there's a Duxbury decision from the 90s, in which the issue of whether a particular expenditure is better suited for general appropriation or special appropriation under Article 12, Section 2, has been litigated. And the court has had occasion in the mid-60s to define what ordinary is, what current expenses are, and that's been applied. And so, for instance, in Oster and in Duxbury, There were multiple issue challenges to certain aspects of the general appropriation. This is in, this is out. This is a capital expenditure for buying land. No, that can't be a general appropriation. That's got to be out. So the idea, as I understand it from the legislature, is that with scrupulous attention to Article 12, Section 2, you can accomplish what the framers set out to do, which is that legislators can't feather their own nests. They can't enrich themselves with the legislation that they're enacting. How can, in light of the cases that we have, interpret the distinction between special and general as it relates to ordinary and current expenses, how can they coexist with our statement that general appropriation equals authorization for contracts?
I believe this case needs to come down to the standard, because if you try to do that analysis, if you look at SDCL 4-8-1 on appropriations and the general concept that if you have an implied and express contract, as Justice Kern earlier talked about, you have to have consideration. That consideration comes either from a general appropriations bill, a special appropriations bill, a reoccurring appropriation bill. If it comes from another funding source, non-state funding source, such as from the counties or the federal authorities, that takes it out of the purview of Article 3, Section 12. But it's the Attorney General's position that if this court were to indicate that a general appropriations bill doesn't come underneath Article 3, Section 12, it would be the first court in the nation to say that. Mr. Chief Justice.
I understand that argument. I understand your general appropriations argument. I think you said earlier, maybe I misheard you, you said that you ultimately, however, land in the same place as the legislature.
in terms of that issue. Did I miss hear
you? Not of that issue, but in answering the nine questions, if this court were to adopt the Todd standard on the tendency to affect a legislator's decision and to recognize what was said, and Attorney General Janklow cited Robinson on substantial versus nominal, if you were to look at the question presented, the Attorney General arrives at the same conclusion when it comes to retirement, Medicaid, selling park stickers, foster care. The other ones, if there's a factual analysis to apply that standard and to look at the facts, in many instances, we would arrive at the same conclusion with respect to conflicts. If you have five shares of a company that has hundreds and thousands of shares, it's nominal. It doesn't tend to affect the decision-making. And so we don't arrive necessarily at the same conclusion with respect to the interpretation of authorized by any law and the precedence that's there. But if you apply a standard such as Todd, we reach the same conclusion in so many cases. In fact, if you take the Todd standard and apply it to Palmer, Norbeck, asphalt surfacing pits, you arrive at the same conclusion. You have to go through an analysis of the facts, and the facts are so important, which is why I would submit to the court, you do have the discretion to issue an advisory opinion. That advisory opinion could pick out four of the very straightforward questions that I've offered today, but with respect to the other five, it could set forth an appropriate standard, appropriate facts like this court has done in Hennig, to talk about foreseeability, which is one of those factors that an attorney general would likely consider, and ultimately arrive at the same conclusion in answering those questions with similar fact patterns.
And would you apply that same test to the ninth question? How do the instances detailed apply to legislator, spouse, dependent, or family member?
That standard is especially equipped to address that question. That standard is going to take a look at what the spouse's involvement in, what the financial gain is, what the circumstances are. That's essentially what the other attorney generals have done in courts in analyzing whether or not a spouse of a legislator should have a DOC lease or whether or not a printing outfit run by one spouse should have a printing contract. I believe that standard would address both direct and indirect. I believe that, and this is from Hennig, that if it's a spouse situation or employee situation, it's that indirect pecuniary benefit. In order to determine whether there's an indirect pecuniary benefit, the Todd standard of whether or not that interest has a tendency to affect the legislator's decision-making is really the question that should be asked. It satisfies the Palmer concern on the suspicion. It protects the taxpayer dollars. And if it's a nominal situation that doesn't affect the legislator's interest, that legislator should be able to serve in the legislator and to have that contract.
Most of the authorities you've mentioned, Attorney General opinions from this state and other states, and you have, in the course of answering some of these questions, related a number of fact-bound factors. Most of the cases, all of the Attorney General opinions that are cited don't involve what we have here, which is a request for an advisory opinion, the exercise of original jurisdiction. Typically, that's not how litigation works. The factors that animate in any given situation are developed through the presentation of evidence, findings of fact, and the unique factors and unique circumstances of a case are litigated through a traditional adversarial method. Is this the right process to get at the rule that you think ultimately, or the guideposts, or the test that you would ultimately suggest? Because the authorities that largely, I have looked at them all. I don't recall one of them cited in your brief that involved a request by a governor in this state or any other state for an advisory opinion coming to an answer or a resolution in these highly, highly fact-bound situations that vary from legislator to legislator.
Other than the NOM 2020 advisory opinion, I would agree with the court. And what I would submit is that the Attorney General, the governor, and the legislator have said, yes, this is the appropriate time. I think the fact that you look at how many times this court has had Article 3, Section 12 cases, how many attorney generals that have issued those opinions, cases resolved such as Castleberry before it went through the court process, bags for a standard. I would submit to you that if this court were to make a determination that it wouldn't exercise its discretion, the attorney general is going to continue to enforce really what Attorney General Janklow set forth in Todd. That's the standard that we apply. However, I would submit to you it would aid the auditor, it would aid the attorney general in the enforcement, and it would aid existing legislators and future legislators to know that that is, in fact, the standard by the highest court, that there may be additional factors that the attorney general should consider in the enforcement. And I think that is why this court should exercise that discretion and make an opinion with respect to, at a minimum, what is the guiding standard and what are factors that should be looked at with respect to that. And again, I believe that four of the questions that are uniform, straightforward, the Medicaid, the foster care, the selling a park sticker, retirement, those are fairly straightforward and would urge this court to issue that advisory opinion so that it's known.
Cases typically say we don't answer them for individual concerns, to address individual concerns. We address them to, or we answer them to address concerns of more broad applicability, not individual concerns. And I appreciate that there's a consensus that the time is now and everyone wants an answer. I get that and I appreciate it, and we're here talking about it. But what happens if that's not right? And in an effort to develop a litany of factors, we don't get them all because they really weren't presented. And we don't know what's going to be presented until the next case comes along with its own unique facts and its own unique circumstances. Can we really meaningfully, in a case that doesn't feature evidence, doesn't feature specific developed record, hope to capture the essence of a test that becomes workable?
The answer to that, Justice Salter, is absolutely yes. By adopting a standard such as Todd, that's a guiding standard. By adopting factors such as this court has done in Hennig, typically this court adopts factors that it indicates as a guide, a consideration, but not a conclusive set of factors. Those assist the Attorney General in the enforcement, would assist the auditor in making payment determinations, and would assist the legislature. So I do submit it would be fully appropriate, and that is the request of the Attorney General, to once and for all give us what the standard is, and if appropriate, any factors this court would like us to consider in the enforcement of that standard.
This hasn't been talked about yet, but let's assume whether we're talking about general appropriation or special appropriation, and let's say it's within the context of Article 3, Section 12, and comes within that, the purview of that. Can a legislator remove the taint of that by saying not voting for the appropriation or not voting for a special appropriation?
Not under current rules, because if one were to go to asphalt surfacing, and I think you have to go to Justice Henderson's dissent to get all the facts, but I believe it was Kruger had removed himself from that vote, and the court had indicated that was not sufficient, and it was still a conflict. So I think the answer would be no, based upon this court's precedence.
Well, isn't that even consistent with the text of the Constitution that says any member during the term for which he shall have been elected, not voted, but elected?
Yes.
Counsel, you had indicated that should the court adopt the legislator's view that we would be an outlier in the nation. Did you finish your remark on that?
The only arguable state that has said it doesn't apply to general appropriations would be New Mexico, and that would be the Baca-Staten determinations. I would submit close reading of that would indicate it's undecided. What happened in those cases, New Mexico has a provision much like ours where school districts are not included in their conflict provision. What had occurred there is the court was looking at if there was a general appropriation that went to the school, did that automatically pull those funds back into their conflict statute? And the court said it did not. So I would submit if you look at all the states that have addressed this, they've indicated that a general appropriation falls within the conflict statute. New Mexico would be the one undecided state.
Yes.
So in an effort to maybe put that into some perspective, so that's an outlier, but it's an outlier in the universe of, what, five or six states that have a provision like this? Or is it a broader sampling?
Justice Salter's right. Not every state has an exact constitutional provision. I would expand that a little deeper if you include some of the Attorney General opinions that were cited as well as the court decisions. But it is a sample. But again, there's no court that held a constitutional provision such as this does not apply to general appropriations. I think the best you can say is Baca and Statton. It's undecided.
Okay. So maybe the sampling is small, but I can understand your point. But let's finish the argument. So it sounds bad to be an outlier, I suppose, but what if we were an outlier? What adverse or negative effects or consequences that we need to think about could result from that?
I don't think that would do justice to the plain language of Article 3, Section 12 that says authorized by any law. I don't think it pays justice to STCL 4-8-1 and what an appropriation is, and the concept that you can't have an implied or express contract without consideration. That consideration has to come from somewhere. It comes from the appropriation process.
Other questions for Mr. Jack?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
We've heard arguments from all three counsel justices. Any other questions that have been prompted? Want to ask counsel? Okay. At this time, then, we'll consider the case submitted, and the court will issue a written decision. I appreciate counsel's arguments in this case. The briefing is very helpful. Thank you.